The third case of the morning is number 042593, Bagby against Experian Information Solutions Incorporated. Mr. Smith.
Please the court, counsel. Good morning. I apologize ahead of time for my voice if it sounds a tad hoarse. Under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, Section 1681I, there are two parts of that act that are at issue in this case. First is the duty to conduct a reasonable investigation upon being alerted by a consumer that there is an inaccuracy in one's credit report. The second that we're going to discuss today is that the credit reporting agency, upon receiving this dispute, must convey all relevant information that they have regarding this dispute to the furnisher of that information within 5 days so that they, too, can conduct an investigation and within 30 days respond back to the consumer. Whether or not an investigation is reasonable is one of fact for the jury. The very term investigation, though, it means examination or inquiry. Experian said that in their investigation, they said in their brief that they investigated by sending a consumer dispute verification form, suggesting and pretty much admitting that this is the entirety of their investigation, the sending of a form. The form contains one line encompassing Ms. Bagby's dispute. Ms. Bagby was one, as you read, who was a victim of identity theft from her own mother, unwittingly knowing that her mother had opened accounts in her name, then giving her a card to use for college, not knowing that this was actually, at the very first instance, opened in the name of Cheryl Bagby. Ms. Bagby alerted them who the culprit was, who the imposter was, and told them, "This is my mother." But all that Experian did was sent on a form that said, "Customer states true identity theft." Experian suggests that this is all that they have to do, is send on a consumer dispute verification form that's reasonable in and of itself, and then they do not have to go beyond the furnisher of the information for this investigation. That's in direct contradiction to this court's holding in Henson. Henson itself said, this court said, that while the credit reporting agency can rely on their subscriber, the furnisher of information, in creating a consumer report, and recently said so yesterday in Sarver, you can rely when you're first putting out a report on your furnisher of information that it's accurate information. However, once the consumer disputes this to you, then you can target resources and conduct a more thorough investigation, suggesting, this court suggested in saying that just relying then on sending out the CDV, this consumer dispute verification form, and waiting its return is not going to be enough. And in this case, for sure, it was not.
How was she damaged?
She's damaged because at the time,
how?
She had to actually pay off a bill that was not hers and for expenses that were not hers, that she would not have paid had the investigation done correctly, would have deleted this. Keeping in mind that no argument is being made that this is her account and she's responsible for these funds. The account was deleted. It was determined it was not hers. It was not hers. The mother admitted it was not hers. But because these companies wouldn't take it off, because Experian would not remove it, so that she wouldn't be harmed further from a balance remaining on her credit account, she had to pay it off, which is something that she would not have done otherwise. And that's how she's damaged. And she's entitled to those damages because she's entitled to any damage that she suffered as a result of their failure to investigate. And had they investigated this, she would not have been compelled to make this payment.
Now, when the challenge was made and the reinvestigation occurred, Experian did find several others that were deleted, right?
Yeah, there were others that were deleted, but they were deleted because of the response from their furnisher, and that's it. But they did delete some accounts.
How were they deleted?
I believe, if I recall correctly from the record, that the furnishers did respond by ordering that they do delete them, if I recall correctly. Some of them may have been deleted by Experian doing it on their own. I don't want to say for sure. But yes, as you stated correctly, certain accounts were in fact deleted. This one was not.
Well, the Discover and Sears were not. They were verified.
Yes. Discover and Sears were verified, and Sears was one mainly that stayed on that my client ended up paying off.
So how were they damaged by Experian's action, though?
Well, again, had Experian utilized their resources, as this court said in Henson that they should, the cost-benefit analysis shifts markedly to the consumer's benefit once they're notified. Had Experian done an investigation, one of their own, and, as I'll hopefully get to in a few moments, conveyed the relevant information regarding who the culprit was, then within 30 days, as the law suggests, this item would have come off her credit report. Anybody could have determined, as it was ultimately determined, this was not her account. They made that decision, not us. They decided to take it off her credit report, and they did. Had they done that within the 30-day period as required by law, my client would not have paid this off. It wouldn't have been there to pay off, and there'd be no reason to pay it off. It was no longer a threat to her. It no longer posed a problem of her getting credit in the future. But this thing staying on there and having a balance.
Is she having any difficulty now getting credit? Is that what you're saying?
No, now she's not having difficulty getting credit.
What?
Not anymore. Not that they've taken it off.
Well, you said in the future.
Had this stayed on her credit report.
Oh, I see. All right. But
had this never been removed.
Right.
Okay. But throughout the period of time that she disputed this, until ultimately after she finally paid it off and litigation had ensued, the item comes off of her credit report. It's not a problem anymore. But the damage she suffered is when this was not coming off, and this being a young person fresh out of school is going to need the use of her credit, made the wise decision to pay it off so that there's not another existing credit card balance on there. So that's how she's damaged, and it's an out-of-pocket expense. This court's decision in Henson was also followed in Cushman in the Third Circuit and in Stevenson. Those were also cases where the courts have also held that once we shift from what we call a 1681EB claim, which is the creating of a report, to an I claim, things change, and that cost-benefit analysis changes. Cushman, Stevenson, and this case all involve the credit reporting agency passing on a coded dispute, the same they did here, taking the dispute, reducing it to a code, and passing it on and waiting for the response. They targeted no resources. In those cases, Cushman and Stevenson, and in this case, no resources were targeted. And you can't say that the furnisher themselves was a resource. That was the cause of the problem in the first place. The second problem was that when they conveyed this consumer dispute verification form, or when they conveyed the dispute to their furnisher, they have a duty to convey all relevant information. And the plaintiff, in this case, provided the information that the imposter is, in fact, her mother. Her mother did this. Experian simply sent on information that consumer claims true identity theft. And they say in their brief, we don't have to communicate every detail. I agree. You don't have to communicate every detail. Just that, all that, which is relevant. And reasonable minds can conclude that the fact that the credit reporting agency knows who the imposter is, knows who opened the account actually, might be relevant to that account holder. A reasonable mind could find that Experian, knowing who opened this, should have told Sears and Discover or whomever that we know who the imposter is. We know who opened it. We know whose signature you have on the credit application. Common sense tells us that this opens doors in an investigation, knowing who the person is that did it. They can look at signatures. They can look
at... You think that they're obligated to do all that to get a signature expert?
Not necessarily. It depends on the facts of every case. But in this instance, I think it would have been a good idea. They could definitely have pooled their resources. They could definitely have taken the application, or at least informed Sears, hey, we know who the culprit is. So you can see that the person who you're sending bills to, and you might be getting bills paid, it might be coming from the same address as the person that's disputing to us. Don't be fooled. This isn't an identity theft situation where it's some stranger gained access to a credit card or a social security number and had started opening accounts and charging things up and maybe changed an address. The imposter in this situation is going to look a lot, as far as identification is concerned, is going to look a lot like the actual consumer whose name this account is in. And that's something that they could have told them, and that could have helped. They could have looked at the, they could have at least helped Sears look at the purchase patterns. Where are these being made versus where Ms. Bagby said she was while she was having this credit card away at school? Where the bills were getting sent? Out of what checking account were the bills getting paid? This is information Sears could have had, had Experian told them and conveyed all relevant information. This was pretty much the same kind of situation as in the Cushman in the Third Circuit. In that case, the court went on to say, to appease Experian's argument in this case, where they say, where Experian says, hey, we don't have to go beyond the furnisher. We could rely on them unless you prove to us we shouldn't rely on them. Cushman said, your failure to give them all the information. Cushman was an identity theft situation, too, where the person said, I might know who this imposter is. And they said, had you said identity theft instead of this account is not mine, that might have changed things. And you can't rely on the furnisher because you didn't give them enough information to rely on. In other words, you've created their being unreliable. That's what Cushman said. That was a Third Circuit decision. So even though they didn't convey all relevant information to help Sears, they also created Sears being an unreliable responder by not telling them everything they could have known and had this matter resolved. I see that I'm running out of time. I want to reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll hear now from Mr. Bromberg.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to start off with, I think, Judge Coffey's questions concerning damages, because I think it's important for this Court to understand exactly what's in the record about damages that were caused by the reinvestigation. Now, plaintiff has claimed in front of this Court that if a reasonable, or what they contend is a reasonable reinvestigation had been conducted, that Ms. Bagby would not have paid her Sears account off and would not have paid her Discover account. However, they only cite two pieces of information. They cite the December 12, 2002 credit report that was sent to Ms. Bagby recording the results of the reinvestigation. And they cite two pages from her deposition transcript. So pages 38 and 39. It's Exhibit A to the plaintiff's exhibits below. Obviously, the credit report can't show that any payments were made in response to the reinvestigation because it constituted the notice that Ms. Bagby received of that. Now, if you look at page 38 of the deposition transcript, she talks about the Sears account. And she says that she paid off the Sears account when she learned about it. Now, the record is clear. She learned about the Sears account in February of 2001. She didn't contact Experian until November of 2002. And by that time, the Sears account had already been paid off. So there's no possible way that she can claim that she made those payments because of a failure to conduct a proper reinvestigation. Now, if you turn to page 39, what you see is the discussion of the Discover card. Now, there's no indication that she made any payments as a result of the reinvestigation. In fact, there's no indication she made any payments at all. What Ms. Bagby says is that her account at the time of the deposition was approximately $2,700. Well, if you go back and you look at that December 12, 2002 credit report, I think it's on page 6, you'll see the entry for Discovery, for Discover. And that shows a balance of $2,726. Now, I would submit to you, Your Honor, that that is not evidence that any payments were made in response to the reinvestigation. To the contrary, if anything, it shows that there were no payments that were made in response to the reinvestigation. Now, Ms. Bagby may have had reasons why she wanted to pay off these accounts. She didn't submit a police report. She didn't contact the creditors directly. It's very possible she wanted to protect her mother. But there is no evidence that she would have that she decided to make those payments as a result of anything that Experian did. Now, plaintiff has also suggested that if Experian had provided information about the identity of the supposed identity thief, that the Sears and Discover would clearly have taken those off of her accounts. The first point is that argument's not properly before this court. plaintiff did not raise it below. No evidence was submitted in connection with it, and I would submit that it should not be considered by this court. But I'd also just like to make it clear, it's by no means clear to me or to Experian that the result of informing Discover and Sears that Ms. Bagby's mother was responsible for those charges would have resulted in those charges being removed. I think it is very possible that they would have found that she had either authorized or ratified those charges, because, of course, the dispute didn't take place until November of 2002, many, many months after Ms. Bagby was aware of the charges. Furthermore, it's not at all clear to me that the credit reporting agencies would have allowed Ms. Bagby simply to say, these aren't my accounts, without demanding that she cooperate in the prosecution of her mother. And I don't think it's by any means clear that she would have done that. So this is an issue that raises a factual question, which we could have submitted evidence on, that we didn't have the opportunity to, because it was not raised below and is therefore a quintessentially waived argument. Now, we also believe that Judge Cannelli properly found that the procedures that were used by Experian in this case were reasonable. Now, plaintiff contends, based upon the Henson case, that Experian had a duty to conduct an independent reinvestigation. Now, they don't contend that it was unreasonable to rely upon Sears and Discover in this particular case. After all, those are the companies that would have received the applications for those accounts, and they would have had the information about the various charges, et cetera. So they had all the information that would be used to do the investigation. Furthermore, it's undisputed that they had in the past been reliable sources, and Experian did not receive any information suggesting that they wouldn't respond reliably to a request to evaluate Ms. Bagby's claims of...
When Experian contacted these two vendors,
yes,
it did state in its request for verification that the credit card holder had said there was fraud involved in this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose that hadn't been said by your client. Suppose they had not informed the two commercial outfits, Sears and the other one, that was the problem as stated by the credit card holder. Would they have complied with it? Would your client have complied with the law then?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. That would have brought them into the situation in the Cushman and the Stevenson cases. In the Cushman case, the problem wasn't that the defect that was found in the defendant's action was not that the defendant had failed to conduct an independent reinvestigation. That wasn't even an issue in the case. The defect that was found by the Third Circuit in the Cushman case was that the defendant had failed to inform the sources that there was a claim of identity theft. In the Stevenson case, Stevenson's a very complicated case, and the ruling that the plaintiff points to is actually part of an affirmance of a finding that there was no prompt response. Now, as part of that finding, the court observed that the CDV that had been submitted in that case was insufficient because the dispute was too complicated. That's a very different situation from what we have here. Now, plaintiff also relies upon the Henson case. I would submit that the Henson case actually supports us, because Henson does not say that there is a duty to conduct an independent inquiry in every single case. What it says is that in some circumstances there may be a duty to conduct an investigation, but that depends upon whether there's any reason to doubt the reliability of the original sources and the cost and benefits of conducting an independent investigation. Well, I think the evidence in the record is clear that the sources here were reliable, and as Judge Cannelli found and as we argued in our brief, the cost and benefits, that factor supports what we did in this case. So Henson is actually a case that supports us. Now, Your Honors, moving back to the omission, I think I've covered that, Your Honors. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I think I have covered everything that I was planning on covering today.
Thank you, Mr. Bromberg.
Thank you.
Sir, you have 4 minutes left.
The question of causation of damages is also a question of fact for the jury. And as the record will point out, when before the disputes in this matter, the balance and the credit limit matched each other, and then after that, they started to dwindle down because plaintiff started to make the payments on the account that she had to. Another point about damages that I didn't have an opportunity to comment on when Justice Coffey asked me is what other damages she suffered. And one of the things she does suffer is also a lowered credit score, and that is a damage.
Doesn't it show that they're paid off?
Sorry?
Doesn't it show that they were paid off?
Now they do. But remember, the statute requires that they conduct this.
I said, doesn't it show that they're paid off?
No, it does not. At the time that the investigation was complete, it did not. At the time the investigation was complete, my client then had a maxed out credit card on a credit report that wasn't going anywhere. And as we presented in case law, it's been determined, it's been argued, that the relationship between balances, credit limits, and numbers of accounts all affects one's credit score. That's what drives the score down, and that's something that she had to deal with for a period of time while this remained on a credit report beyond the 30-day requirement of the Fair Credit Reporting
Act. Did it max out because of her expenditures?
She admitted that she made some expenses buying books and things for college, but by no means did she spend the rest of it, and a lot of it
Her amount?
Your Honor, it's a good question.
That'd be helpful.
It would be helpful, but Your Honor, I got to tell you, I don't think it was. It was more. It was even half of it, quite frankly, and that's a big difference between a full credit amount and half of it. But it wasn't even approaching. And I think the record will show you it wasn't even approaching, close to maxing out this credit card. Her mother maxed out this credit card. Her mother bought it and got it in her name. Used it herself and maxed it out, and her daughter used it for books and necessary supplies at school, and that was it. And she did make payments and agreed to make payments for that which she used, and she ended up paying for much more than that, and she ended up paying more amounts of money than she used. But her credit score also was lowered a great deal because of the fact that the card ended up being maxed out, and that was something that she herself did not do. Counsel commented, and I want to comment again on Henson, where he said that the Henson court says that some circumstances arise where the creditor would have to go on beyond its initial furnisher. I believe that Henson is very clear, and it was followed by Cushman and Stevenson. And Henson tells us that although they can rely on them, once they get a dispute, once they're told that the information is inaccurate, they have to conduct an investigation, and merely going to that furnisher and merely creating this document might not be enough. That's at least a question of fact. And in the face of a case like this, where there is an identity theft, and they know who the imposter is, and the fraudulent account was opened, in that circumstance, a question of fact has to remain whether or not all that was done was reasonable, and was reasonable such to the point where it would assure maximum accuracy. And that's the mandate of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that they have to assure maximum accuracy. And you have to ultimately ask the question, does simply putting together this form that says true identity theft and sending it out and not saying anything more, does that help assure maximum accuracy? And that begs the question, what does true identity theft mean? What is that supposed to tell somebody? That this is truly a victim of identity theft? Of course it is. But how about we know who the culprit is and we know how you can figure out what happened here? None of that was passed on. So I ask that the decision of the district court below be reversed. And I thank you for your time if there's no other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Indeed, our thanks to both Mr. Smith and Mr. Bromberg for very succinct explanations of their respective positions. The case will be taken under advisement.